Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Just after the Second World War, Cavantown had a great military tattoo to celebrate the life and times of Eoghan O'Neill. It was attended by some young blades from Glengevlin, teenage boys drinking stout and smoking till their eyes came out on sticks. They returned that night to the peaceful hills of Glengevlin, unsatisfied by the dull and tedious ceremonies in Cavan Town. So for further entertainment, they decided to turn the peaceful hills of Glen into a carnival of anarchy and confusion. This they did by calling at houses, shouting in windows, all sorts of strange tales of woe in voices of familiar neighbours. Mrs. So-and-so is having her baby, come quick. Tommy so-and-so is taken ill, he'll not last till morning. The big brown cow is stuck in the ditch, you better come out. A different tale at every house, all in the mask of another person's voice, and at sufficient houses to create a busy stir on the roads. Soon people and lamps were moving over the hills in all directions. They passed each other in the night, suspicious and mystified at first. "Hi, where are you going? I know where I'm going, but where the hell are you going?" When they finally realised what was afoot, they mobilised into search parties to find the young rascals. The boys lay low in the ditches, while grey-haired men stalked the roadways in their short tails. The young blades would laugh tears for weeks, remembering all that manhood swinging in the wind. Of course, they knew also that if they were caught, they would pay dearly. The fur would fly. An edgy suspicion infected social life for weeks. Old men stared at young men in long shafts of silence. The whetstone made a slow, disturbed sound on the billhook. But in the end, no one was ever found out, and the secret of who turned the peaceful hills of Glen into such turmoil that night was never revealed. A song was made about the incident, which ridiculed the victims, and its rendition at wedding or in public house was often followed by heated debate. That was 50 years ago, just after the war. Cavan Town was thinking about Eoghan O'Neill, and the young blades from Glengevlin were idling the time as if there was oodles of it. Since then, Europe has been fashioned into a single sort of entity. Japan has rebuilt its power. The Cold War has come and gone. The Soviets have vanished like snow off the rope at Checkpoint Charlie. But as to the identity of those young blades, no one is saying much yet. In New York and Boston, they sing, "The old ones are all dead and gone, the young ones turning grey." And in Glengevlin, the forestry is peppered with little empty shells that once were homesteads. The wind whistles through the broken walls, and even the story itself will soon be forgotten.
Last night as I lay dreaming of pleasant days gone by, my mind being bent on rambling to Ireland I did fly. I stepped on board a vision and I followed with the wind till first I came to
There was a time in my life when yards were old and the world was young. Death was a distant thing. It happened without fail at the end of sad books and films. In those glorious days of youth and sunshine, a pet kitten could die of pneumonia, or the family dog could stray under the wheels of a bread van. Accidents happened, but generally, in the grand scheme of things, death was a natural demise that took place at the end of a normal life. At that time, newspapers were merely a source of football photographs for scrapbooks. Comics were much more exciting. Politics and wars were of no consequence, and politicians were only owl idiots who shouted and roared from the backs of lorries. Girls were mysterious beings who smelt wonderful, but were most inconstant. One August, they were playing hopscotch and skipping with you. The next, they were wearing high heels and makeup with nylons and notions to match. Before you know it, you are on the electoral list, and politicians are real people who can pull strokes for you. Suddenly, you care about wars, and almost without noticing, you are scanning death columns in newspapers. Guards and priests appear to be very young indeed. Mirrors frighten you, and friends appear old-fashioned. Overnight, it seems your youth has flown. You can't believe it. You, who lived for life and love and song and dance, you shake your head. It can't be, but it is. You are a middle-aged man. Gradually, a sense of knowing, an awareness of the universe, settles down upon you. There's a rhythm to it all. Despite yourself, you achieve a modicum of wisdom. You realise that we are all only passing through this time and place. Death holds no fears. It's as natural as twilight. Recently, I attended a funeral and was quietly marvelling at the rhythm of it all. The 90-year-old corpse had been presented most professionally. The funeral parlour was suitably sombre, and the chief mourners arrived on cue to take their places for the ritual. They sat in rows on each side of the coffin, and soon the parlour filled. I had never met the deceased, a parent of a distant friend. As apparently the deceased was a much-loved character in the locality, the crowd soon spilled out onto the street and backed up along the footpath. Cars and tractors were double-parked. The sympathisers laughed and chatted about greyhounds and milk quotas and topics of the day. As they moved closer to the coffin, all conversation ceased and hands were got ready. It never varies. Family members look up startled as you take their hands and nod your condolences. Sorry for your troubles is the accepted murmur of grief. Sorry for your troubles. Sorry for your troubles. It's relentless. My initial reaction on glimpsing the corpse was that she had been one hell of a big woman. The hair was full and snow white. The skin was soft. I decided on a variation of the troubled theme. Sorry for your mum, I muttered as I progressed up along the line. They looked at me with puzzled expressions. I put it down to their grief and continued sorrowing. Outside the parlour, fags were lit and feet were stamped. I fell in with company. He was a great man, they said. That man could drink porter till the cows came home. He never worried a day in his life. The poor wife, muttered another. She put all those kids through college single-handed. Your man never missed a football match in 70 years, someone else said. Or a dartboard, quipped another. This chap had to be larger than life, I thought. Such men are rare. I casually asked who this sporting phenomenon could be. He's inside there in the coffin, said an astonished mourner. I gazed at him, open-mouthed, and closed my eyes in horror. When I told him of my indiscretion, those within earshot looked away and coughed uncomfortably. To ease my embarrassment, a kindly lady in the group said she'd heard me once or twice on the radio. Wherever do you get the ideas from? She asked. As I struggled for an answer, she smiled at me, patting my hand. It's serendipity, she declared. I looked at her, somewhat puzzled. Serendipity, she whispered, with a nudge and a sideways nod of her head in the general direction of the long black hearse.
If I say there is something permanent about a graveyard, you will know what I mean. It is one of the few places that produces an aura of certainty, until the resurrection. Highgate Cemetery in North London is at variance with the life of the capital. All that frisson below in the sprawling metropolis, oddly at odds with the heights of interment up here by Hampstead Heath. Faithful departed, although not quite departed, to judge by the Gothic inscriptions on the elaborate edifices that mark the resting places of the merchants that drove the city in its Victorian heyday. Fulsome descriptions of good husbands and loving fathers, more prolific, it would seem, than devoted wives and mothers, and many with mausoleums of limestone and granite, solid expressions of their worth on earth as a signal to substance in the life above. Some in tombs and vaults, barred on the outside, hardly to keep the dead within, more with the purpose of keeping the living from excavating for imagined rings and jewellery and artefacts that may have been buried for the afterlife. And so the guide on a Sunday morning is full of information. Through this gate came the horses with the black plumes, drawing the hearses with the caskets. Established church turned to the right, Anglicans and others to the left, in death as in life. And not immune either from the will of the living. The guide said it was difficult to keep the cemetery landscaped and tidy, what with the cuts and Thatcher policies and local authority spending. The acres were overgrown. And, she pointed out, we could see for ourselves, with that foliage of ivy and weeds in determined profusion, even in autumn. Which is why she encouraged donations from among her band of followers. Those who had come up here on a Sunday morning, well, what better way to spend an occasional London Sunday than to respectfully tramp here and dawdle there among those who lived like we had for a time in their lives in this city. And here and there, a grave well tended, usually from a bequest in a will. And then we came across a grave so splendid in its wealth of flowers and red roses, so well kept in its munificence, that you could see its monumental magnificence in the distance before you arrived at it. What merchant prince was here, whose substantial fortune bequeathed to sustain in death what he may have occupied in life? Not so. Here on a plinth, the face of the man who died in poverty, whose writings and edicts were taken up by more nations than ever called themselves Christian or Muslim, whose life, eked out in Germany and London, left a doctrine that was to be followed, in theory rather than practice, by more people than ever read his ponderous analyses of human history. This one, immune from the cuts of capital that had rendered scraggy the tombs of his lifelong enemies, the merchants and capitals of 19th century London. Here now, defiant in its sumptuousness, the grave of Karl Marx, exponent of socialism and of Marxism, champion of the downtrodden as he saw it. More bitter wars fought in his name in the splintering political continents of Africa and Asia than he would ever hear about. And the great influential theorist of human behaviour, who said everything can be explained by economics, whose grave had more spent on it in a month than he likely in life had in a week. Looking out over the London, where he obsessively laboured in the British Museum to lend footnotes to his theories. And since Germany was divided after the war, the East German government, in keeping with its Marxist ideology, paid for the upkeep of his grave in London. And now, a few months ago, East Germany coalesced with its western half, the triumph of capitalism over Marxism, if one wants to see it that way. And doubtless there's a lot to be sorted out now between what were the two Germanies as they become one again. The civil services and administrations will be unified. A zillion items of expenditure, great and small, will have to be reviewed. Somewhere in among the lists will be the upkeep in Highgate Cemetery of the grave of Karl Marx. Perhaps the decision will be to continue as before. He may rest easy, or then again, he may not, in the knowledge that his grave will continue to be kept in its monumental glory by the capitalist Deutschmarks of a system which he railed against in life, but which sustains his memory in death.
Let's drink to the hard-working people.
Jenny's hair was her crowning glory, her best feature. So the adults said. It was rippling blonde and cascaded down her back. And yes, it was gorgeous. I'd have swapped my straight brown hair for it any day, and even thrown in my white teeth for good measure. She and I were about the same age, and I'd more or less grown up with her. Her mother was my favourite aunt, and from as far back as I can remember, I spent my summer holidays with them. They'd a pub in town and a seaside cottage nearby, and we'd the best of both worlds. The year I was 10, my aunt found my eldest cousin locked in a passionate embrace with the barboy. Reckoning children to be more expendable than staff, she banished the lot of us to the cottage, to be minded for the whole summer by Hannah, a distant cousin many times removed. Hannah was big and bosomy, and a great one for stories and cuddles. She was reputed to have the power of healing, but she was very secretive about it and the various people who called for consultation. One morning there were tufts of hair on Jenny's pillow. We all thought it funny, Jenny included, but when a golden clump came away from her head in her brother's hand, we sobered up. I was glad it was white teeth that were my best feature, and that they were firmly in place. Hannah looked decidedly grave as she examined Jenny's head. Then she stood us in front of her and put us on our honour. She wheeled her bike around from the shed in the back and pedalled off in the direction of the village to phone my aunt. She arrived in double quick time with the family doctor. He examined Jenny's head, shook his own, looked hard at my aunt and asked Hannah where he could wash his hands. She directed him towards the back kitchen and brought him a wedge of yellow soap and a white towel that had come from America. We were banished outside and the door closed on our curiosity. Inside, the adults held a whispered conference. We heard voices gradually being raised as Hannah began arguing with the doctor. The only words we could hear were hospital and specialist, and that's because the doctor shouted them. Then he marched out and sat in his car. My aunt wasn't long after him, but she was crying, and Hannah kept telling her that it would be all right and to trust in her. When they'd gone, Hannah went off again and returned with a parcel of bones. After boiling them for hours, she let the range go out, and when the turf had cooled, she made a paste of the ash and the marrow from the bones. She smeared it over Jenny's hair and then swathed her head in strips of old sheeting. The treatment continued for several weeks, and the smell grew worse with each passing hour. The day my aunt and the doctor were to return, Hannah washed Jenny's hair. No more had fallen out, and a faint chicken-like fluff was growing on the bald patches. We all cheered, and Hannah hugged Jenny. We were too young to appreciate Hannah's powers, but we did know the doctor was impressed, because he drank a lot of tea and asked a lot of questions, to which Hannah gave him very short answers.
Give me a head with hair, long, beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, streaming, flaxen, waxing. Give me down to there,
hair,
shoulder length longer.
I suppose you could say it was something blue that I tripped over in the bookshop in Westport on the May bank holiday weekend. It was the 1811 Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue, subtitled Bookish Wit, University Slang and Pickpocket Eloquence. One quick thumbing and I knew that I loved it madly and needed it badly. Of course, it wasn't a first edition, but a 1980 reprint of a book that first saw the light not in 1811, as the cover announced, but in 1785. The original was written by an antiquarian named Captain Francis Gross from Richmond in Surrey. Captain Gross died in Ireland in May 1791 while on an antiquarian tour and was buried in Drumcondra. 205 years later, his vulgar dictionary is bursting with the life of the cheats and pickpockets in cockfighting pits, inns and bawdy houses of the 18th century. Much of it is not vulgar as we would understand it, not necessarily coarse, but common, of the street. And you certainly hear the jostling and shoving of the street in its pages, which are peopled with swells, rum coves, cheats, morts, culls, drabs and dells. This rum band uses a language of its own called cant, with phrases like twig the cull, he is peery, or your man has his eye on us. If you robbed someone's pockets, you weeded them. If you rubbed him up and down with an oaken towel, you beat him with a cudgel. The threat of hanging was never far from the mind of the cove, and if he got his comeuppance, it was on Wry Neck Day, when he would ride a horse foaled by an acorn, the gallows. Tyburn was the most famous of the hanging venues, and a Tyburn blossom was a young thief who would eventually ripen into the kind of fruit that would hang on the gallows. Politically correct, the 18th century cove was not. For example, of a man who'd had smallpox, he might say, the devil ran over his face with horse nails in his shoes. Someone we might call sun-kissed or freckled might have been christened by the baker, that is, sprinkled with bran. And even the blonde bombshell was merely turnip-pated. A person with a wooden leg was timber-toe. The plump man was double-tripe, while a slimmer one might be spindle-shanks or spider-shanks. A squeeze crab was a sour-looking little man, and a squinting man or woman was said to have been born midweek and looking both ways for Sunday, or born in a coach and looking out of both windows. The clergy are treated unkindly. A parson is a tickle text, and one who preaches too long is a spoil pudding. Their congregations come in for the cove's sharp tongue too. Roman Catholics are said to belong to the breast fleet because of the custom of beating their breasts in contrition. All sorts of professions are given rough names. The tailor is a pricklouse because of the way he disposes of the parasites with his needle. A drummer is a tormentor of sheepskin and a fiddler a tormentor of catgut. A wife is a whither go ye, wives being sometimes asked to question their husbands whither they be going. And a mistress is a wife in watercolours, because like a watercolour, the relationship is easily effaced or dissolved. In the 18th century, gin was known as strip me naked. I wonder why. And even the phrase for tea was scandal broth, I suppose because of the amount of scandal that was discussed when drinking it. The Irish were as much of a presence in the London of the late 18th century as today, as their colourful phrases in the dictionary show. It tells us that a twiss was a Dublin word for a chamber pot. And Mr. Richard Twiss, having in his travels given an unfavourable review of the Irish character, the Jackeens thought proper to christen this utensil by his name. Suffice it to say, Captain Gross adds, the baptismal rites were not wanting at the ceremony. Gross also informs us that Irish drinkers often toasted the little gentleman in velvet, who, it transpires, was a mole who happened to be digging his hill when King Billy rode by and who tripped up the king's horse. But the English got revenge on us by calling Ireland the urinal of the planets because of the frequent rain. They also said somebody sporting a black eye had been at an Irish wedding. I could go on, because the 1811 dictionary gives a veritable banquet of food for thought for the word hungry. But I don't want to be a spoil pudding, so I'll trot off to the nearest inn for a strip me naked and tonic. Or perhaps I'll just make myself a cup of scandal broth.
Smile, an everlasting smile. A smile can bring you near to me. Don't ever let me find you gone, 'cause that would bring a tear to me.
It's of little use trying to explain why the air hostess on our flight from Ireland to Malta was beautiful. My wife, too, was stricken by her charm, so there must have been something beyond everyday heterosexual attraction. She had full, wavy, black hair, soft but strong features, spellbinding eyes, and a warm and ready smile. But here I go, trying to describe the indescribable. She possessed her very own beauty, and it was more something about her, in her, rather than her looks, which contained the secret. She appeared not really to belong where she was, with us, the passengers, in a bullet-shaped thing flying south, or as if she was here by chance, and being her own friendly self was helping with the job, dispensing the meals and her graceful smiles like gifts to us. Sometimes she just stood there, looking inwards contentedly, as if she was thinking back or forward to some joy-filled place, of which she was a messenger here among us. But don't get me wrong, there was nothing otherworldly about this young woman. If anything, she appeared to be more sensually and sensitively real than the rest of us. While we were occupied with the usual things, meals and magazines, all the time trying, inobtrusively, to keep an eye on our hostess, the pilot suddenly announced with a modicum of excitement in his voice that we should look out on the left side for an interesting sight. We all did, of course, and were overwhelmed. At this stage we were crossing the Alps, which were invisible under a thick cloud cover in a pinkish-grey colour because of the setting sun. But out of this desert of clouds jutted a number of jagged, blindingly white peaks, like wolf's teeth, menacing, reaching up threateningly for the thin metal skin of our container, although maybe some 20,000 feet below us. It was frightening. At the same time, the vista was breathtakingly beautiful in its sunset-colored immensity. We were all gasping and murmuring, and only reluctantly turned our faces away from the windows when the sight slowly sank away behind us. When the three of us had settled back into our seats, there was our air hostess standing beside us, and with her most serene smile, she asked us the strangest, most perplexing question of my life so far. "Well, are you happy now or sad?" For a moment, I was at a loss for words. I blushed and stuttered something like, "Oh, very, very happy," but immediately felt the hopeless inadequacy of my answer. I had just looked down on the highest mountains of the continent. I had seen the planet in its raw inhumanity, a sight about as homely and as hospitable as the pictures we see from Moon or Mars. How could you be happy in the face of that? But how dare one be sad, looking at such tremendous majesty? There was no answer to this question. The question was its own answer. Ah, happy and sad really opposites? Are they really mutually exclusive, or are they not rather wrapped into each other inseparably? With her question, our messenger had gracefully lifted us into a realm beyond words. Meanwhile, the plane was hurtling down the western coast of the Italian peninsula. Looking out towards the east, the sky was a deep blue-black. On the western side, the setting sun created a glorious spectacle of orange and red. For a few minutes, the plane seemed to travel the dividing line between night and day, darkness and light. Or was it happy and sad? But then night took over, and the surface of the earth displayed its own constellations, the cities we passed over sparkling like the Milky Way. The planet, indeed, was showing off. Rome, a lake of lights. Naples, likewise. Then the ink-black sea. Some Sicilian fireworks, and then, close already, the winding streetlights, the straight landing lights of Malta. We were there. At the exit door, our hostess waited and, with a gentle wave of her hand and a smile, presented us with this other island. A swell of warm air enveloped us with a strange, new, spicy scent. We stepped out of our time capsule back down into our happy, sad world.
All things considered. Ceaselessly, the magpie's rattlesnake call and noisy dance makes you sit up. It's like a raid. They drop from the sky and are simply there by chance, hopping down back walls and as quickly gone all at once, before the intemperate gull swings into view again, and so you have me idling by a window. Where did all the time go? From the rainy seasons out the country to the high summers of wraparound light, as far as the swirling mackerel skies and the heavy cattle flummoxed by the wrong, unmoving gate. We saw it all from under the stars. Now I only know what isn't there.
This morning's programme was a selection from the Sunday Miscellany Archive, with the following pieces all first broadcast in the 1990s. Disturbing the Peace by Michael Harding. Serendipity by Nicky Barry. A Journey to a Tomb was by Kevin O'Connor. Jenny's Hair by Patricia O'Reilly. The Vulgar Tongue by Catherine Ann Cullen. And Happy or Sad by Peter Jankowski. And finally, we heard All Things Considered, a recent poem by the late Gerald Daw, whose death was announced this week, and we broadcast it in his honour. He was a much-loved voice on Sunday Miscellany and will be much missed. The music this morning was Spancil Hill by The Wolf Tones, Cuckoo from Benjamin Britten's Friday Afternoons, performed by the Choir of Downside School, Purley, Salt of the Earth, performed by Joan Baez. Hair was performed by the Cowsills. Words by the Bee Gees. And Forays in Partisium, played by Lang Lang. A reminder that Miscellany will be at Belfast Book Festival in the Crescent Arts Centre in Belfast next Sunday afternoon, that's the 9th of June. The event is now waiting list only, but you can find details of all events at the festival at crescentsarts.org. And there's no on-air Miscellany next Sunday, as there'll be an election special on RTE Radio 1, but the programme will be back as usual in 2 weeks' time. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back to this morning's programme on the RTE Radio app or on the programme website.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.